happy birthday, Steve. And we're talking about all things Steve. And we just had that lovely conversation with Owlish about what Steve's life would have been like in the, I don't know what word I was going to put there, in the past, in his origin time.
In the pre-war times. Yeah.
In the pre-war times. We just wanted to kind of talk about Steve and continue this kind of conversation about Steve's relationship with where he is in both time and space, because unlike most of the other characters, we get to see him go through these really immense changes in his life, and it changes his characterization as he moves along as well. So I've kind of in my head, and I think Fanon does this too, categorized him as three separate Steves. We have the pre-serum Steve that we get a bit of in the First Avenger. And there's some flashbacks, I think, in Winter Soldier, maybe, where he's small, he's best friends with Bucky, and he's feisty and fighty, and he doesn't like bullies. And he's frustrated about his lack of ability to help with the war effort. And then we get this oft-ignored but important mid-Steve that gets very little screen time. That's the post-serum, pre-time travel Steve. I think really the only bit of that we get is in the First Avenger. And then the rest of the Steve that we get is the post-serum, post-time travel Steve, who's undergone this extreme trauma and culture shock of being uprooted and transported 70 years later, which, you know, that'll mess with a person.
Yeah, we've talked about it a little bit before in different things about his body, and like that this, like, it's still when he wakes up in the First Avenger slash, you know, 2012 Avengers movie, like he's still not used to this body. He had like, what, 6 months maybe? if not 2 months. I have no idea what the span is between the Vidoray and him putting down the Valkyrie, but it's not a lot. So his body doesn't really know what to do. But then there's also the incredible, like, and I think Evans does what he can with what he's given in terms of like modeling grief and kind of everything else. But I don't know. He just feels like, how could he have any roots at all in himself or anything else? And that's one of the reasons that I think he is so intensely and strongly, like, fiercely, not only about Bucky, but about team, and why some of his actions in later parts of canon are so, like, because he couldn't pick his entire family, he had to pick one and like cling to it with all he was. Mm. And he couldn't accept that there was consequences to those actions because he'd already been through too much trauma. And yeah. So he just had to keep digging his heels in and saying it'll be okay because nothing else has been. So it has to be okay.
He's identified the thing that will solve the problem, and he just focuses on obtaining that thing, and then that's like tunnel vision. It's all he can manage. And talking about just to, you know, knock back a little bit, talking about Evan's portrayal and doing the best he can with the grief and everything, we have to talk about the deleted scenes that I think so popular in fandom spaces that some people, myself included, sometimes forget that they weren't actually in the movie. But there are those couple of scenes of him that were from 2012 Avengers that didn't make it into the theatrical release or any of the DVD releases. I think they were potentially on like a DVD or digital release as deleted scenes, or maybe they were only ever like released on YouTube or something. I don't actually know. But we see him on the subway, we see him looking through the files, and there's you really get the sense of loss and grief and displacement from him in those scenes in a way that we don't have time to get from the rest of that movie. And you can almost see why they cut it, because nothing else gets that much time really. And it's also a little depressing to have that be the introduction for him when I don't think that the movie gives him a resolution to those feelings. And even with the boxing scene that is in the movie, and we see how much PTSD he has and how he's trying to work through it with violence. We don't, you know, I don't think that the smile at the end when they've won and New York's a little bit destroyed and Tony barely didn't die, that doesn't feel like closure for me for what he's gone through.
No, because it's not.
Yeah. And then a lot of what he can, a lot of the choices he continues to make show that he hasn't worked through that. And like, I really honestly, I can't, I know many people are very upset with Marvel for not focusing more on that. But for me, it's very much, I have to remember that these movies weren't made for the fandom. That's a very small group of the people that this market is aimed at. And it was very clear what they chose their focus to be. And that hasn't really changed throughout the movie. So it's certainly not a surprise that we didn't get like a lot of deep introspective exploration of culture shock for Steve with the time travel. But it certainly leaves a lot of space for fandom to have fun exploring and creating and
wondering. And I mean, look at, like, as we talk, like, we've had Falcon and Winter Soldier and Loki and WandaVision, and we're all still, there's still holes in those.
Yeah, there's just, like, so much you could, like, look at how many years of comics we have. There's so many stories you can tell.
Yeah, and so to have, like, any expectation that the movies would be the complete story is, if we have that expectation, like, that's a failure on us. Because even with 6 hours of The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, I have, I don't know, 7,000 to 10,000 more questions that I would like, other scenes that I would like. Like, that's really just where our job comes in. Like, that's the point of transformative works. And folks, by the way, if you hear a bunch of stuff in the background that Ferret can't, ambient noise Ferret can't edit out, I'm at our beach house and we're in the middle of a tornado warning. I'm safe, I'm fine, but the weather outside's a little bit crazy. So I am fine, I am safe, but there is some ambient noise going on that I cannot control. But it's, I don't, like, it just, it's one of those things where, like, as a storyteller, it irks me the holes they decided to leave and the small ways they could have done something. Like, no, we didn't need all those deleted scenes, but like, there could have been a throwaway line or something at some point to acknowledge that he was still struggling. We could have even, you know, had like longer scenes in Endgame about like, I've done this once, I'm not doing this again. Like, I'm really tired of losing people. Something like that. You know, there were ways to do it. And so as a storyteller, I'm like, you just left a lot of stuff. Like, you left a lot of stuff hanging and you didn't have to, even if you were trying to, you know, make this audience happy. But then the other part of me is like, there are 12 people that write these scripts and they don't always even meet each other. And then the people that write the scripts are not the actors that say them and then are not the editors that make the decisions. Like, movies are too big to tell one story.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is like, you know, the MCU is too big for itself in a lot of ways.
Yep.
Taking on decades of comics canon and then taking that and, I mean, making their own transformative works, because like the MCU is fan fiction. Yep. And the weight of that and the potential depth of that is so much that, we could spend all day like highlighting all the holes, you know, and it's just, some people find joy in that. I think it's almost a fruitless endeavor because it's inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, my response to that always is just like, that's what fan fiction is for. And I don't get bothered by it.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to talk about it for the simple fact that then it's a bunch of you know, prompts that I can throw at people on Discord, but it's not, I don't know. It's, we've had this conversation with every fandom forever. Like, they're never going to be perfect. There's always going to be holes. Like, I think I'm a fairly comprehensive storyteller, and I still go back in my own fic and find holes that I should have thought about, and I didn't.
Yeah. So in some ways, it's a blessing that we have enough of Steve that we get to, like, it asks all these questions that we as fandom get to answer in as many different ways as we can, and those ways can all be valid. And I think that having the three distinct Steves that I think genuinely are shown to have different characterizations, like,
yes,
early
pre-serum
Steve genuinely sees the world differently than post-serum, post-time travel Steve. And I think that the act of having his body go from the very opposite of a threat, even when he'd want it to be, into a sort of inevitable constant threat, is shown in some ways. He becomes much more like contained, I want to say. Like, he's more controlled.
Somebody pointed out once, and it was a friend of mine who's a U.S. Marine, actually, pointed out that Steve Rogers fights like a girl. Like, he wasn't trained, like, as a boxer in, like, all of those kind of things, because the person who taught him how to fight was Peggy Carter. And Peggy taught him how to fight using his size to his advantage.
Yeah.
And then when he got bigger, he still did. So he still is, like, lower sense of gravity, and, like, he's still really scrappy. And even though he could absolutely fight, like, the body that he is given by Erskine, he fights like a 1940s girl would have been taught to fight.
It's interesting that we see that come, like, we can look at just the evolution of his fighting style, but then we could look at the evolution of, like, his body language.
Yep.
As a pre-serum Steve, you see him, like, hunching over a lot. He's very curled in on himself, and he tends to keep his face down and look at the ground, but he's also frequently gives a vibe of frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we don't get very many scenes with him, but even at the Stark Expo scene, he seems constantly, like, a little on edge, a little uncomfortable. And I think he carries that uncomfortableness through into Big Steve, but we see him, and also additionally in the middle there, he did have military training. And once he joins the 107th, one can assume that like, he had post-serum military training after the USO as well. Because his bearing changes, the way that he carries, like, think about him in Winter Soldier, shoulders back, he starts putting his hands in his belt when he stands up. He stands at military rest a lot, and he becomes broader and larger, but he's also quieter and more contained and more controlled in general. He doesn't outburst with his body, even if he's outbursting with his voice as much. And I think
It's like he's resigned almost. Like, I mean, I just, like, trauma moment here. Trauma literally physiologically rewrites your nervous system's ability to cope with things. Like, that's the definition of trauma, is that something has happened that overwhelms every system in your body to where it is stuck in fight, flight, or freeze. And it's, like, almost like the record keeps skipping and it can't land on anything for a little while until your endocrine system and everything else calms down. And then you can stable, your entire nervous system stabilizes again. People in perpetual communal trauma in particular. So people who live through war, who have been frontline workers in the last 2 years. People with, you know, terminal illnesses in their family or in their own bodies. It takes on a different level of rewriting your body and rewriting your brain chemistry and rewriting everything. And I will very happily make the contention that Steve Rogers was in trauma from the moment Bucky fell until Endgame.
Yeah.
And so if you think about that,
it's hard to argue against that.
Yeah. I mean, like, and I'm sure there are people that would try to do that with me on some level, or, like, he was fine at some point or whatever, but, like, I hope you wouldn't, because it really is like I don't think he was in trauma necessarily before. He was not in, like, this level of perpetual trauma before Bucky fell. He was traumatized. Obviously he had a traumatic childhood. But there was moments of his childhood and his early adulthood where his endocrine system, like, could have stabilized. And he was in control of his own life.
And yeah, elements of control that he
elements had. Of control. But like on some level, from the minute that Bucky fell, there were things about his life that were completely outside of his control. And I think, again, that's one of the reasons that we see him make the choices that he makes. They're all trauma responses.
Yeah.
That are just seeking desperately to have stasis again. All he wants, all his entire body wants is stasis. And he can't get it.
It's there are so many things that I love to explore with his character. And I think that, like, me being someone who loves hurt comfort so much, so much of that is born out of this perpetual state of trauma.
Yes.
But we can see like the what the culture shock of the time travel has done to him is obviously fascinating to explore, and something that we get so little canon of that it's kind of free range. But also so much real life we can draw on from that, because even though he time traveled, and generally people don't, there's still, you know, people experience culture shock when they, you know, move from one culture to another. And especially if there's trauma aligned with that, like refugee, moving to another country, there's a lot there that we could assume would be similar to what he's feeling when he goes through that. And to go from the trauma of the war, and even the frustration and the stress before that of wanting to help and continuously being denied. You know, he had this idea when he was small that the restriction was that he wasn't strong enough to fight. And that's, you know, to internalize that concept when the messaging at the time was entirely do your part, to be told that his part was to sit still and shut up because he was a weakling. That's obviously going to have a huge impact on his character in a formative way. But then to get the serum, to go through, like, he goes through basic training as pre-serum Steve, he goes through all of that, he gets the serum, which is terrifying, but he chooses to do it anyway. He lives through the pain of that, which I'm sure stays with you as well. And then he's given the thing that he thinks is the obstacle in his way. And then they're like, yeah, no, we still just need you to put on tights and dance around on stage for a while. That's you helping. And that is not at all the vision of help that he had in his mind for contributing to the war effort. I feel like though those two frustrations had such a profound impact on who he becomes after the time travel, in addition to the perpetual state of trauma and the culture shock, that those two are interesting places to dive into Steve and really dig in and see like what we can unearth in an archaeological sense for what that created in him and how it would affect his relationships and the way that he sees the world. It's fascinating. And like at the end of the day, I just feel really sorry for him. I think he's had a shit life.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is that he has. Like, it's actually fascinatingly something that I find really interesting in Falcon and Winter Soldier, to juxtapose it with what the show says about John Walker, which we won't get into on this podcast. But so I've thought so much more about Steve since seeing Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
And it's like, now that I've seen this contrasted thing and I've been forced to figure out why that character itched me so much, and it was designed to, like,
yeah, it's supposed
that
to
character is designed to itch.
Yeah.
But it's like,
it as I kept
very effectively. So I kept trying to put my finger on it, and it's like, I just keep finding more and more ways where I was like, this is why Steve worked the way that he worked.
Erskine was right. Like, it was critical that they choose the right person. And in many ways it was, you know, he wanted to make a sacrifice for the war, and what he ended up sacrificing wasn't something that he ever could have conceptualized at the time as being what he was going to have to give up. You know, he was ready to give up his life.
And I think more than anything, though, he wanted to matter.
Yeah. He wanted to help. Like, he genuinely wanted to help. He wanted to contribute. He wanted to protect people. He wanted to contribute. He didn't even want to be the hero. Like, he wasn't like, I want to go in and save everybody. He wants to be one of the many who were going in to save everybody. And, you know, that circles back around to what you were saying about his, like, desperately clinging to having a team, having a family. You know, he wanted, from day one, he wanted to be part of something. He didn't want to be the thing. He wanted to be part of something. And we never see that desire to be part of something in John Walker. He wants to be a statue, you know, like, he wants to be on a pedestal.
Yeah, which is a huge part of the two different military industrial complexes that they were a part of as well. Like, you know, it's really, I think one of the things that makes Steve Rogers work the way he works is that he has so sociological moment, America scores 95 out of 100 on the individualism scale. 95 out of 100. We are the highest country in the world that privileges individualism. When that scale was, like, when you look back at, like, I don't know, I want to say, like, they started this, the people that were analyzing it can go back as far as the 1910s, I think. And so when Steve was growing up and going into World War II, our score was something like in the 60s.
Yeah,
that's a massive shift in individualization versus communal understandings of the world.
Even just looking at World War II, like, propaganda, the message that was being sent was, do your part, be part of something, contribute, help, do your part.
Somebody said once, I remember after 9/11, not after 9/11, but, like, when we were in the quagmire that was the quote unquote war on terror, I want to say like 7-8, like, people had officially decided it was shit, but we weren't out of it yet.
Yeah.
One of the things a lot of social scientists were saying is, you know, in World War II, we were told to start sacrificing.
Yeah.
And in after 9/11, we were told to go shopping.
Yeah.
Because what we needed was a global economy, and the world was so different. So I also obviously love contrasting those, you know, the world around it kind of thing too.
And we can bring that right into his relationship with Tony, because he sees Tony as selfish. He's come from this perspective into Tony's extremely modern perspective. And Steve wants to lay down on the wire and Tony wants to go shopping. And we don't have to interpret that as either of them being right or wrong, because there are legitimate, there's power in, oh, and now we're going to get into, like,
I mean,
the billionaires, but I don't want to go there. But I do want to say that Tony does have power that he can wield from a chair behind a desk, and Steve can't understand that because he has been told that the power is in active sacrifice.
Yeah, and I mean, we say, like, I've certainly said it in fanfic, and I know we've said it to each other, like, Steve didn't live through the Cold War.
Yeah.
Like, Steve didn't live through Vietnam. And I love the comics that show Steve learning what happened in Vietnam and, like, losing his mind. Like, that makes me always happy on a level. But the other thing I wanted to say about team and family too, that triggered as we were thinking there, is, like, to bring in the single child of an immigrant thing too. Like, just like Owlish said, he would have grown up in a tenement, which is the height of communal living. And we don't know canonically when Sarah died, but, like, obviously he was not, you know, even if he was an adult, like, you couldn't do life on your own in those days. Like, you arguably still cannot, but that's a separate soapbox. But he would have had this highly communal life in a highly communal society. And so then even, like, I think about, like, Tony wanting to give him a whole floor. Like, that's not even just insane. That's traumatic. That's disrespecting Sarah's memory. Like, that's everything. And so, and also, like, just the psyche of immigrants and, like, how hard you have to work and everything else. And the first generation immigrants are always, you know, are a specific thing. Even then, the Irish diaspora was very specific. And so family comes before everything, because the government could take it away at any minute. And so it's, if Tony represents the man, which he definitely does at the beginning, like, that's a whole other layer of, like, what the fuck are you talking about? So, yeah, I think I love
this man. I love the story potential, the character potential that is there. There is so much that we can unlock and explore. And like, I feel like you can spend a year and a half on 10 minutes of his life because there's so much there. It's like, I'm like that slap the car meme. I'm like, you can fit so much hurt comfort in this bad boy. Like, ugh.
He is, it's why for me, Tony and Steve are the, like, even if they're not romantic, like, honestly, like, but they are the thing that holds the multiverse together because they are the two stories we are always trying to tell. And, you know, I mean, that's the joke is that, or the trope is that there's only two stories you ever tell: a man goes on a journey or a man comes home.
Hmm.
And that's their story. A man goes on a journey and a man goes home.
One was life and one was death. I feel like in 616, they acknowledge that more, that they're the, you know, they're the two the binary sides. Yeah, that they are the, but anyway.
I just find it, like, I mean, he's not my favorite character in terms of, like, who I identify with or resonate with, mostly because, like, just for, he doesn't have enough crushing daddy issues for me is really what it comes down to. But no, I jest. I've talked about it before, why he's not the one that's easiest for me to write. It's a little harder for me to get in his head, but he's my favorite to analyze.
Yeah. I think that I find Tony easy to write in a lot of ways, but I'm more likely to be repetitive with writing Tony. I tend to write kind of the same aspects of Tony over and over again, and I have to work a little harder to flex my Tony wings and be like, what else is here? What else could I look at?
Okay.
But I feel like I could write 700 different Steves that all felt like they could be, like, that they were dialed into canon and still wake up to a new Steve the next day in my brain.
Interesting.
Box.
I think I'm just repetitive all the time, so I don't ever think about that.
I get bored with myself if I do the same thing over and over.
Oh, that's fair. I just stop writing. Which everyone will notice if they've looked at my AO3 recently. When I get bored with myself, I just stop writing. Words exist somewhere, I think.
Somewhere.
It's just, yeah, like, the sociologist in me loves talking about Marvel for these kind of reasons. I don't find this depth in, you know, even in other comics. Like, I don't find this depth in the DC canon in the same way. And I love the way that we have to attack and kind of look at things. And I respect that, like, I can find this depth in stuff like Star Wars or Star Trek, but what I love is the groundedness in the American reality that's just different enough that I get to poke holes and kind of bring up things like, there's a real thing that happens to America when the Civil War and the Vietnam, when the Civil War, that too, but when the Cold War and when the Cold War and the Vietnam War happens, like, there's really significant cultural shifts that are catastrophic. In the same way that, like, in 100 years, trying to explain to somebody what life was like before COVID is going to feel weird.
Yeah.
And it's all just so, so fucking rich. And I'm so grateful that we live in a time too, where we're getting more of, like, even if I don't want to watch WandaVision or Loki or Hawkeye or these new ones, we're getting more and more space for the canon to get richer.
Yeah. I can't remember if I was talking to you or someone else, but we were talking, or maybe I was observing someone else's conversation. So I'm sorry, credit unknown, but talking about, for all I know, it was a Tumblr post. That's where my brain is right now. There were words on my screen and the words were about how, I think it was a conversation. It was Ashley, now that I'm thinking about it. We were talking about how it would have been cool if they could have done TV shows from the start to explore a lot of these characters.
100%.
But acknowledging that it was the immensity and the success and the way the MCU was pulled off that has allowed them to come to a place of doing TV shows. Yeah. So from a capitalist perspective, we totally understand why that didn't happen. It happened the way it needed to happen. The TV shows would not have been anywhere near as successful as the movies were.
But, like, also Marvel did TV shows and they weren't as successful because they weren't as good as these ones now.
Yeah, these characters had to... Yeah, it had to play out the way that it did. Again.
Yeah, like, but would I have loved if, like, you know, instead of doing a detour into Guardians of the Galaxy, we had done a detour into like a mini series of Steve and Natasha trying to figure out the blip. Yes, I would have liked that.
Yeah, there's so much there that could be done, and it would be super cool if actors lived forever without aging and we could just, you know, continue having content. But
which is legitimately why I'm excited about this What If cartoon, because like cartoons do live forever. And so like they get to kind of tell us different stories, which could be really fun.
Yeah, and there's so much good in the Marvel cartoons that already exist, and much of it cut short, like EMH. But there's so much that can be explored that way with so much freedom that I hope we're unlocking all kinds of cool stuff. But yeah, I know that, you know, I assume that the mouse will continue to want to milk Captain America as a viable source of income for as long as possible. So we can only hope that that will result in more content, perhaps Steve's from other universes, like bullet points.
Yeah, I mean, they're building, like they built a Steve Tony roller coaster in Paris.
Yeah.
So it's not going anywhere.
But even if it does, even if the heyday of Captain America is waning, or even if Chris Evans is retired from ever putting on the stripes and star again, I think that like what's awesome is that we've got all this space to keep exploring him indefinitely. Like,
yeah, I mean, people have been doing, because you know my belief that every single comics run is a transformative work. So people have been doing transformative works about Captain America since the 60s.
Yeah, so, you know, let's keep doing it because it's a hella good time. And Steve is a wonderful character to dive into because he's not simple and he's not straightforward and he's three-dimensional and he's complicated. And you can fit a whole lot of her comfort in that, baby.
And what does it always come down to for Ferret? Hurt, comfort.
Put that sad man in a hoodie.